Today on The Takeaway, when public spaces no longer feel safe. How mass shootings affect our relationship with public spaces, you're telling us.
This weekend shootings have been a tipping point for me. I don't go to the movies anymore, and I do a lot of my shopping online.
I'm always on guard, always aware of my surroundings, and prepared to react or act.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's August 8th. Also on the podcast, we're talking the ever-shifting power dynamics of Puerto Rico and Venezuela. All right, let's get going, everyone. School, work, movie theaters, nightclubs, music festivals, restaurants, bars, Walmarts, and houses of worship. These are all places where we want to believe we are safe. But as mass shootings continue to happen in these public spaces, many of you have been telling us that your sense of safety has been deeply shaken.
As a father, I no longer feel safe in large spaces.
I'm afraid.
Every time I go to a concert, sporting event, or even an outdoor art show or food truck rally, I think about the possibilities of something tragic happening.
I'm afraid or thinking twice about going to certain events where there's a large amount of people. I don't go to the movies anymore, and I do a lot of my shopping online.
Sitting at work, doing your things, trying to make sure, you know, things get done, but in the back of your mind, I mean, is somebody going to bring a gun to school? Is somebody going to overreact?
When I'm on my own, I'm fine, but when I'm with my family, I do not enjoy concerts, farmers markets, anything of a large area.
You know, it's just scary to think that sending your kids off to school is an act of bravery.
You're not free when you can't go to Walmart or take your kid to a festival or send them to school.
I always keep my eye on exits. We never sit in the middle. I've taught my children how to evade keeping their eyes on somebody while zigging and zagging. They're 9 and 12. They shouldn't have to do this.
I'm afraid for my city, for our community, and I want to live in a safe place, and I don't know where that would be.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this. And that sense of fear in public was echoed in New York City's Times Square just this Tuesday, when the sound of a motorcycle backfiring was mistaken for gunshots and caused a stampede. WNYC reporter Gwen Hogan spoke to a ticket seller in Times Square on Wednesday who said that she understood the crowd's reaction.
I mean, it's just like this really sad reality. That's how people react. And when I went to see Anastasia, there was this really loud, like, rat-a-tat noise that happened, and, like, immediately the whole audience got, like, really restless and was, like, looking around to see what was going on. It's just this sad but true reality, and it needs to change.
Today, many of our public spaces are changing because of an increased security presence and surveillance in the aftermath of shootings and other attacks. And while heightened security may put some at ease, others are left feeling even more on edge. If we're going to regain a sense of safety in our public spaces, it's going to take more than just metal detectors and armed guards. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. I have two guests joining me now to discuss the sense of anxiety that many of us feel following public mass shootings and what we can do about it. Vida Beitz is a sociologist at Yale University. Thanks for being with us, Vida.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Dr. Pooja Lakshman, a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at George Washington University School of Medicine. Good to have you with us, Pooja.
Thank you so much for having me.
Vida, let's start with you. When we think about broadly about public spaces, which are now something that become frightening for so many people, what are some of the benefits of having public spaces?
We can never overestimate or underestimate public spaces. We are social beings and we need to socialize. And so public spaces are ways through which we cultivate our communal culture. There is a lot of research that shows that public spaces and being out in public spaces enhances public health. It clearly enhances happiness. It encourages companionship. And it builds our sense of identity in the sense of belonging to a particular place, a kind of a a way of thinking, I inhabit this neighborhood. It's my home. So your home is not just the four walls of your apartment. It's the area in which you feel at home. It's the neighborhood that gives you a sense of feeling at home, a sense of some kind of a shared existence. Public spaces are incredibly important.
Pooja, I want to bring you in here because we just mentioned the Times Square incident, where, which was not a mass shooting, but it was the sound of a motorcycle backfiring and people just running everywhere. Is there a name for that? Because I'm sort of calling it collective PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder that we go through as a society. But is that right?
Well, what it sounds like to me is this collective hypervigilance that we all feel in the wake of mass shootings. And some of the research that we have looking at even folks who are indirect or indirectly associated to mass shootings, so folks who haven't lost a loved one, didn't live in the same town, research that we have shows that there's a decreased perceived sense of safety and an increased sense of fear. So this is something that really has become more and more ingrained in our culture over the past, you know, 20 years or so.
And when you talk to patients about the anxiety that they feel after an event like a mass shooting, what do those conversations tend to center on?
Yeah, so I think what I see is people saying that they just don't feel safe in public. So feeling like, you know, I go to the grocery store, I go to Walmart, I go to the mall, and I don't feel safe because all of these places have been, you know, places of mass shootings or attacks. So there's this sense that no matter where you go, no place is completely without risk.
Vita, taking that into consideration, we just laid out the necessity for public spaces and how important they are to our daily lives. But when you have that experience, when you have people who are saying, as we heard what our caller saying, they're afraid to go to the movies, they're afraid to go to places. I'm scared myself to go to certain places in the aftermath of a mass shooting. What impact does that have on our public spaces and our ability to continue to move in those spaces?
Well, there seems to be a buildup of public pressure on the one hand to have more surveillance cameras, have more drones fly over plazas and neighborhoods and parks, have more security personnel around that people can see and feel that, you know, they might be protected because you have police everywhere. So there is an expectation that if I go out in public, I have to be protected, and that the state will do whatever it takes to protect me. And yet we know that that's really not possible. So it creates this kind of anxiety on the one hand, anger. Why is the state not doing what it should be doing? And on the other, every time there's a shooting or what I call the violent interruption of some kind of collective public life, there is yet another example that demonstrates that you cannot protect yourself or your group of people or your community from such events. So it creates a kind of a bind, right? And anger and anxiety out of which there isn't really an easy solution.
Pooja, off of that, I want to ask you about the psychological effect that security or increased security has on people. But I also want to first ask you about what effect does it have on us relating to each other? Are we human beings becoming more afraid of each other in these spaces, more vigilant of any false moves or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it increases this guardedness that we have, especially in these big public spaces. People are really keeping an eye out, listening very closely to what's going on. So I don't know that it's necessarily having an impact on our one-on-one relationships, our relationships to our close friends or family members. But I think that when we're surrounded by strangers because of these events, we do perceive others differently.
And Vita, as we look at, as you mentioned, the increased security in certain public spaces, how does that impact people? I mean, we're not all in the same class or in the same race. So are there specific times and instances where certain people end up being over-policed or excluded because of these security barriers?
Well, yes, necessarily, because the way that, you know, there's a particular kind of logic to the way that security is imposed on social spaces, right? And so you have to classify populations into categories of, you know, dangerous, potentially dangerous, safe, and so on. And so necessarily you have to have certain criteria by which you do the classification. And so any such classification necessarily leads away from democratic principles of equal access and inclusion and so on. So it's, by definition, an undemocratic process.
And Pooja, that, you know, we heard callers, our listeners who sent in calls, one of them said that they stopped themselves from going to certain places. One of them who was a parent said that they were telling their children, you know, not to sit in the middle of a long row, to sort of watch for different people, to zigzag, you know, in between. What conversations can we have to sort of get us through this if we're feeling that anxious about going out in public?
Yeah, I think that the key is to, whenever events like this happen, to take the time and the space to process what's going on. So to process with yourself and sort of allow yourself to feel that fear and that anger, and then also to process with your family and your community, especially for people of color or folks that might feel especially targeted. I think it's important to connect with your own particular community. And so much of these attacks are about destabilizing essentially our sense of safety and the ground underneath us. So by talking about it proactively, it allows us to kind of take back some of that agency so that it's not just about the fear that you feel, and it's not just about how do we escape from this concert hall. It's more about, let's have this extended discussion about what does this mean? How do we think about this?
Vida, we've got less than a minute left, but I want to get your thoughts on how can we stay safe in public spaces outside of the traditional security measures?
Well, as a sociologist, what I would like to see is a public discussion about what we can do as a society to get away from these binary dialogues. Guns are good, guns are not good, because it's a bind that we cannot get out of. We have to look for alternative ways of thinking about how we will organize our collective public life. Different ideas. We need to have a serious public discussion about what are the possibilities, what are the different visions, what are the ways through which we can do things differently, because the direction in which we're going right now is not a good one.
Vida Bites is a sociologist at Yale University, and Dr. Pooja Lakshman is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the George Washington University School of Medicine. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Puerto Rico has had its third governor in less than a week after the island's Supreme Court ruled that Pedro Pierluisi was sworn in as governor on unconstitutional grounds. Pierluisi had been handpicked by former Governor Ricardo Rosselló just before he resigned on Friday. So on Wednesday, Secretary of Justice Wanda Vasquez was sworn in. You may recall, Vasquez has said she didn't want the position. We've got Michael Dybert back with us. He's the Caribbean correspondent for Bloomberg in San Juan. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So explain why Pedro Pierluisi's gubernatorial appointment was unconstitutional by the Supreme Court.
Essentially, very, very shortly before he departed, Ricardo Rosselló named Pierluisi as Secretary of State, which was a vacant position, and it's second in line in terms of the line of succession in Puerto Rico in terms of the Constitution if the governor leaves. Pierluisi was approved. His nomination was approved by the lower house of Puerto Rico's legislature. It was not approved by the upper house, the Senate, and he just kind of acceded to the governorship. And so basically they the Supreme Court decided that that was an illegitimate move on his part.
Michael, Wanda Vasquez is now governor. We know that she is part of the current ruling party, but she's also said repeatedly that she does not want the position. What's the sense on the ground about her taking on the role now?
Yeah, when she was taking the oath of office yesterday, she looked pretty solemn, I think is what you would say. But since then, I mean, she's given, I'd say, some pretty clear indications that she intends to stick around. She said in a radio interview yesterday that she had taken the role on until 2020, which is when the next gubernatorial elections are scheduled here in Puerto Rico. And I think, you know, one thing that's important to understand about the context that's what's gone on since Friday, especially, is that there's a kind of internal war going on within the governing party here in Puerto Rico, of which pretty much all of the recent protagonists in this drama are members. And you have one wing that's this kind of more polished, I would say, wealthy elite wing, which is the Rosselló Pierluisi wing. And then you have a more populist and I think some would say kind of reactionary wing, typified by the Senate president, for example, Thomas Rivera Schatz. And that they're using the space of the state, essentially, to fight the struggle, which I think, given a lot of the struggles that Puerto Rico is undergoing right now, a lot of people find kind of unfortunate.
When it was first talked about that Wanda would be the next governor, this was before Pierluisi's appointment and then since his stepping down, there were hashtags coming out from protesters saying Wanda renuncia, similar to what they wanted Ricardo Rosselló to do, was Wanda to step down. Does the public still feel that way about Vasquez?
It will be interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple days to week, because I would say that there was a large, I mean, certainly there was an enormous movement to get Rosselló out of power that succeeded. And then there was, I would say, also a lot of pushback against Pierluisi's assumption of the governorship and the way it went down. One of the strange questions that I think has been dogging this process is, you know, Pierluisi is a quite accomplished lawyer and that he couldn't see the legal flaws in how he took over the governorship. I think there may be a sense among some sectors of somewhat exhaustion right now in Puerto Rico, but I would say Vasquez remains a pretty unpopular figure generally among the population and someone who is viewed as really part of the kind of same ossifying and compromised political class that people have been trying to uproot over the last month plus. So the way that that plays out over the next week or so will be very interesting.
Michael Dybird is the Caribbean correspondent for Bloomberg in San Juan and the author of the forthcoming When the Sky Fell, Hurricane Maria and the United States in Puerto Rico. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
This week, President Trump signed an executive order ratcheting up sanctions against Nicolas Maduro's government in Venezuela. On Tuesday, National Security Advisor John Bolton was at a summit in Lima, Peru, where he explained that the goal was to put even more pressure on Maduro's regime, which so far has resisted the United States' attempts to force him from power.
Basically, one way to summarize this to a business, for example, is do you want to do business in Venezuela? Or do you want to do business with the United States?
Meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela is getting worse, with the United Nations estimating that 5.3 million Venezuelan refugees will have left the country by the end of this year. Joining me now from Caracas is Brian Ellsworth, Venezuela Bureau Chief for Reuters. Brian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, why now? Why did the U.S. decide to take this action this week?
Well, we don't know exactly what policymakers are thinking in Washington, but our best guess is they see that Venezuela is slipping a little bit off the radar screen. The narrative that we had in January seemed things were moving quickly and that Maduro would not last for very long. Now we have an opposition leader, Juan Guaido, who has declared himself to be a parallel president. The situation has gone on since January. And Maduro does not appear to be leaving. And our guess is that American consciousness is drifting towards other things. We see North Korea and Iran coming back on the radar screen. And this is the sort of announcement that can help put this back into the limelight.
Explain to us briefly what the U.S. sanctions would do. We just heard John Bolton say for the business community, they have a choice to do business in Venezuela or with the United States. What does that mean? Can you drill down on that for us?
Sure. So it's important to clarify that this is not a Cuba-style trade embargo for the simple reason that a trade embargo would block any business with any citizen or company in Venezuela. This is a prohibition on operations or transactions with the government of Venezuela, which means that private sector is still on the table. part of what's happening is that they are announcing an incremental change, but a lot of this has been going on for much of the year. There was a very broad sanctions package in January. So a lot of the impact from the sanctions program has probably already taken place.
The refugee crisis in Venezuela has continued to grow, with already more than 5 million Venezuelans having left the country. How are the Venezuelan people holding up under the current U.S. sanctions?
Well, the economy has been in crisis for quite a while. I think most would agree that it's not caused by the sanctions, but most would also agree that the sanctions have worsened the situation. It's hard to know exactly what the impact of the sanctions has been versus what the impact of basically a dysfunctional economic system. The reaction that a lot of Venezuelans have, as you obviously referenced, is they're leaving. So now we're seeing people streaming across the border and heading into South America principally. Those who can live off remittances, people have been doing that for a while, but things are also getting more expensive even in hard currency. So a lot of people are simply not making do. If they're not leaving, then they're struggling to get the basic calories that they would need to complete a full diet.
The United States has backed the opposition party leader, Juan Guaido, whose movement essentially stalled. Their goal is to get Maduro out of office. How effective will these new sanctions be in putting pressure to get Maduro out of government?
So it's difficult to know exactly how the sanctions will have an effect. One of the things that they're talking about now is that they now reserve the right to go after other countries for doing business with Venezuela, which is to say, normally sanctions would prevent U.S. citizens from these kinds of business arrangements. They are now trying to say that they will apply financial penalties to companies and other countries. This is the kind of thing that's very controversial because these are U.S. laws and U.S. policies, and to apply them to countries like Spain or India, whose companies are involved in the Venezuelan oil trade, tends to create a lot of diplomatic problems for the simple reason that countries feel like they're being bullied into following somebody else's laws. So they can do this, and the United States has a significant muscle to do so. But this does come at a cost, which is that whatever conversations you're having with these countries would suddenly be taken over by this discussion of Venezuela if you're trying to block a significant portion of India's oil supplies that come from Venezuela. The sanctions experts that I've spoken with say there's not a lot of clear evidence that this is going to change the situation or at least get the desired result they want, which is for Maduro to be gone.
Nicolas Maduro and Juan Guaido had been in talks, at least amongst themselves. Would that indicate any movement towards a political resolution outside of what the United States is trying to do here?
They've been in negotiations, in discussions in Barbados for a little over a month now, and there's not clear sign that they are reaching a solution. Both sides are pretty well dug into their positions, so a compromise there would basically require one of these two parties to abandon what they kind of consider to be basic conditions. So Maduro has not shown any willingness to step down or to create a power-sharing government, and Guaido's camp does not appear willing to have anything other than Maduro's resignation. It's not obvious what they could really negotiate.
Brian, in your experience or in your view, is this potentially a precursor to military involvement by the United States should these sanctions not have the desired effect that Bolton and company are expecting them to have?
If I were to look at previous major military involvement, it would obviously be the war in Iraq. That was fundamentally based on what ultimately turned out to be a false pretext of a national security concern. There have been some attempts by policymakers in Washington to make Venezuela look like a national security concern. I don't think Americans of any political persuasion are very convinced by that. A, I don't think it is. And B, I just don't think there is the frenzy being created the way we had in the run-up to the war in Iraq. That doesn't, of course, mean that they won't do something like this. And airstrikes and the like have been common in places like Syria and Libya. I don't immediately see that on the table other than very loud saber rattling.
Brian Ellsworth is the Venezuela Bureau Chief for Reuters. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we want to give a quick shout out to our production team. Alex Boti, Isabel Angel, Amber Hall, Rob Gunther, Jose Olivares, Holly Irungu, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, Danny Lewis, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, and Josh Christensen. Jay Cowett is our director, Claire McKean was our engineer this week, Jivika Varma is our intern, and David Gable is our staff superhero and assistant. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.